and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 24th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, measuring the oscillations of stars hotter than the sun, how physical warmth promotes psychological warmth, and the wrap-up of science's pre-election coverage of how U.S. presidential candidates John McCain and Barack Obama view science. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Stars are the engines of the universe, making the elements that make up everything else. To get a better understanding of stars, the National Space Agency of France, along with the European Space Agency, launched the Corot satellite in late 2006. Equipped with a space telescope, among other things, the satellite has been monitoring the light intensity of three stars. And these stars, like the Sun, oscillate at thousands of different frequencies simultaneously. If you transpose these oscillations 18 octaves into our aural range, you can actually hear the difference between stars. For example, here is a star known as HD 49933. And here is the star HD 181906, again transposed 18 octaves. In a paper in this week's Science, Eric Michel and colleagues report this oscillation data from the Corot satellite and the extent to which these oscillations are similar to those of the Sun. The research will help in refiguring models to make better sense of stars in general, and in particular, how these stars evolved and how old they are. I spoke with Michel from his office at the University of Paris.
We are talking about measuring very low variation in the light, quantity of light received from the star. Such results have been expected by the international community working on stellar physics for more than 20 years, and that they are expected to open a new way to look at the stars, and they offer us the possibility to compare the theoretical prediction and the theoretical models with stars which are different from the Sun in various aspects, and that this is important to test this model.
What are the oscillations that already have been observed in our Sun?
Variations in the light curve received from the Sun, and they have been used, for instance, to probe the Sun and know how the temperature is increasing inside the Sun, how the Sun is rotating below the surface, things like this. So the idea now is to do the same with other stars and to see how other stars with different masses, different chemical composition, different temperature, or different rotation behave to help to improve our understanding of the stellar structure and evolution.
So you were testing the theoretical underpinnings for how the Sun works against these other stars.
Yes, the point is that all what we know about stars at the moment has been according to models, which have been compared with the Sun, mostly, and with other stars, but through observation of the surface of those stars.
And did you find that these other stars were similar or different?
In the present case, they are somewhere in between, I would say. Their oscillations, for instance, can be compared to the Sun and are the same kind of oscillations, working with the same kind of process, but in slightly different conditions. And at the same time, they are sufficiently different to help to probe the effect of different parameters like temperature or rotation. In this case, the idea is to have stars which are close to the Sun but different enough to tell us something new.
What do you expect to learn from these measurements, the change in how the various oscillations of these other stars work?
Yes, it's a bit soon, but what we expect results and confirmation or information on a few crucial points, one of them being the evolution, the age of the stars, which means the speed at which they evolve. So it becomes possible to test these kind of things with such observations. If we can reach this goal, we could help to fix the determination of the age of the stars much more precisely than it is at the moment. Because at the moment, when you look at a star, you cannot say, you have an uncertainty of a factor of about approximately 50%.
And knowing the age more precisely will help how exactly?
Well, then you have to consider stars in a broader context, which means that stars are the elementary blocks, the elementary units of surrounding universe.
Is the Haro satellite sensitive enough for long-term study of stars very, very far away, or are we only going to be looking at with the satellite stars that are nearby?
Well, we, for observational reasons, in fact, because we are looking at very, very low amplitude oscillations, very low amplitude signal, and so we have to select the brightest stars. We made it possible to have a representative set of stars to look at, but of course, the brightest the star, the best the information we get. So we do not select preferentially distant stars.
Eric Michel, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Eric Michel is lead author of a paper on the oscillations and granulation in stars hotter than the sun. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Now with the policy update, Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny is here with three recent international announcements that reflect important developments in science and technology in the Middle East.
First, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, an intergovernmental group of 57 Islamic countries, has decided to create an Islamic Citation Center. The center will track scientific publications and activity. It will also promote cooperation among Islamic scientists and science and technology institutions. The long-term goal is to improve the quality and impact of research in Islamic countries. Funding for the center will come from the government of Iran, and it will be managed by an international committee headed by the Iranian Ministry of Science, Research, and Technology. Second, the United Arab Emirates is planning to create the Middle East's first international center for telecommunications research and technology. The Etislat BT Innovation Center is expected to start up in early 2009 at the Abu Dhabi campus of the Khalifa University of Science, Technology, and Research. It will be supported through a joint agreement between Khalifa University and two telecommunications companies, Etislat and BT. Finally, the Egyptian government has signed an agreement with a computer technology company, IBM, to jointly invest roughly $30 million as part of a three-year partnership to create the first North African Nanotechnology Research Center in Cairo. Starting up in January 2009, the center's research agenda will include alternative energy sources, energy recovery, and simulation software. IBM is also involved in a collaboration to build the King Abdullah Institute for Nanotechnology in Saudi Arabia.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. The next time you need to make a good first impression with someone, you might want to hand him or her a warm cup of coffee. In a paper in this week's Science, Lawrence Williams and John Barge showed that this kind of unconscious priming with a warm object, including literally handing someone a cup of coffee, can affect how people think and behave. Physically warm objects promote psychological warmth, and likewise, physically cold objects promote psychological coldness. I spoke with Williams from his office at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
What we found is that people are very sensitive to the physical environments and they're very sensitive to warmth information. And this paper demonstrates that there's a pretty close association between physical warmth and interpersonal psychological warmth, such that incidentally holding something that's warm or cold to the touch can influence how you feel about other people and can also influence the type of choices you make as far as other people are concerned.
So how exactly did you test whether physical warmth promoted psychological warmth towards another person?
So what we did is we used a priming manipulation, priming technique. What that means is that we expose people to a stimulus environmental cue, and in our case, manipulated whether or not that cue was physically warm or physically cold. We had people hold a cup of hot coffee or a cup of iced coffee, and that was the essence of our manipulation. And in doing this, we could essentially determine whether or not there's association between physical warmth and psychological warmth by comparing differences in these two groups of people on our measure, which was taken from a classic paper in social psychology by Solomon Asch that was published in 1946. that was the first demonstration of the sort of notion of, or idea of interpersonal warmth as far as psychology is concerned. In that measure, we presented participants with a six-word description of an ambiguous person. We called them Person A to keep it. I said him, but we wanted it to be as gender-neutral as possible. And we just described Person A as being industrious, cautious, determined, traits that have nothing to do with the idea of being a warm or a cold person. And then what we asked participants to do is to rate Person A on a series of traits, half of which were related to the idea of being a warm or cold person. We also had them rate Person A on traits that are unrelated to the warm-cold dimension. And what we found was that there was a significant difference between the two groups in their ratings of Person A on the warm traits, such that participants who held the hot coffee cup saw Person A as being more generous, more sociable. The people who held the cup of iced coffee saw Person A as being less generous, antisocial, selfish. But we didn't find a difference between the two groups on ratings on the traits that were unrelated to the idea of being a warm or cold person, things such as honesty, attractiveness, being strong. So it wasn't just a global positivity sort of bias that holding something warm makes you feel good and then you just see more goodness in general. It was a very specific association between sensations of physical warmth and judgments of interpersonal warmth in this, again, fictional stranger.
So you found a way to put a warm cup of coffee or a iced cup of coffee into the participant's hand.
Yes. We actually had to be pretty sneaky about how we had participants hold this coffee cup without really cluing them in to the fact that the coffee cup was the critical aspect of our experiment. So we had a Confederate meet participants on the first floor of the psychology building. And on their way up to the lab, she was holding some textbooks and a clipboard and also a coffee cup that was either hot or iced. And she just sort of briefly, innocuously asked participants if they would mind holding her coffee cup as she jotted down some information, the time of their participation, their name, and then took the coffee cup back while they were on the elevator and then brought them into the lab. So participants had no idea that holding that cup was the critical aspect of the experiment. They thought that once they came into the lab, filled out informed consent forms, and then were given the questionnaire packet where they were evaluating Person A, that that was essentially the entire experiment.
Still, though, were there any concerns that the experimenter who handed off that coffee cup may have influenced the participants in some way?
There were. So we did have those concerns, and that's essentially why we ran the second study to eliminate any possible experimenter bias from these results so that we can have a better handle on the extent to which the warm-cold manipulation itself, per se, led to these significant differences between the two groups.
And what was in the second study? What happened there?
So in the second study, we had participants hold and evaluate either a warm or a cold therapeutic pad, pads that either become instantly hot or instantly cold. And we had participants retrieve these pads after they started their experiment, so they didn't have any contact with their experimenter. And afterwards, we didn't want to sort of use the same exact dependent measure. We were influenced by some work that showed that, as far as priming effects are concerned, that they can influence your judgments, they can color your judgments and your feelings, but they can also influence your, like, the self. They can change people's behaviors. It's not only about perceiving warmth in others, but it can also perhaps lead to an increase of feelings of warmth in oneself. And in order to do this, as our measure, we asked people to make a choice. And participants weren't aware that this choice, again, was what we were really interested in. They just thought that this was the end of the experiment, after they had evaluated these two therapeutic pads. We didn't particularly care about the evaluations. We just wanted an excuse for participants to actually hold the two therapeutic pads, either the hot pad or the cold pad. But what we asked participants at the end of the study to do was to choose as a reward for participating either a gift that they can give to a friend, or we framed it as something that they can take for themselves. What was key for us was the framing of the gift. And what we found, again, consistent with the idea that having this sort of physically warm experience can create a sense of interpersonal warmth in participants. Participants who held the hot therapeutic pad were more likely to choose a gift for a friend whereas participants who held the cold pad, the icy pad, were more likely to choose a reward for themselves.
What accounts for this effect in which people seem to transfer their feeling of physical warmth with a psychological feeling of interpersonal warmth?
We think that these results reflect a deep association between physical warmth and psychological warmth in people. It's a little bit up to debate in how that association is formed. It could be that this is something that people learn very early in life through their interactions with caretakers, so being held. But these associations are reflected in our mental architecture and the structure of our brains. Recent neuroscience findings have shown that the same brain area is responsible for processing or particularly active in processing information related to temperature, monitoring temperature change, perceiving temperature changes in the environment. And that same brain area, the insula, also is particularly active in processing information related to sort of interpersonal warmth, how trusting we find others, perceptions of trust in other people, feelings of social exclusion or inclusion.
What does your research mean then beyond, say, making sure to hand someone a cup of hot coffee if you're trying to make a good first impression?
Well, I would say that that's certainly one potential application or implication of this work. For us, the basic finding is that we need to sort of be fully aware of just how sensitive people are to their physical environments and how subtle cues in the environment are capable of shaping our thoughts and feelings and our decisions and behaviors in the moment. And this research speaks to the importance of the idea that we have to be sensitive to the lessons from development in terms of our adult decisions. And human development, the idea that being taken care of, like having close contact with a caretaker, having those experiences of warmth and affection, both physical and then also psychological warmth, are critical for modern-day adult judgments and decisions.
Well, Lawrence Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Williams is lead author of a paper on how experiencing physical warmth promotes interpersonal warmth. Read the paper in this week's Science. Many scientific issues are never discussed during presidential campaigns. After all, there are more pressing things for voters to think about besides, say, whether the next big space mission should go to Jupiter or Saturn. But that decision, along with many decisions that will be made by the next president, concern scientific issues. In this week's Science, Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis has compiled two sets of those issues, one set that the candidates are both talking about now, and one set whoever is elected will have to think about once he gets into office.
What we wanted to do is let people know about some issues that haven't gotten any attention on the campaign trail for perfectly understandable reasons, but that the next president is going to have to face sometime in his first term. In other words, he hasn't talked about them on the stump, but you're going to hear them in the news sometime after he takes office.
So we're not talking about issues like the economy or energy or space or health. We're talking about issues that are scientifically important, but maybe not hitting the mainstream media.
Right. Well, they are issues that sort of take a side seat, I won't say a back seat, to those issues. So you'll hear them talk about energy independence and reducing greenhouse gases. But you won't hear them talk about whether you can regulate carbon dioxide emissions using the Clean Air Act. But they are going to have to deal with that. Likewise, you'll hear them talk about terrorism. You may even hear them mention bioterrorism. But you won't hear them talk about reducing the chances of having the research being misused and what the guidelines should be so that scientists can stay on the right side of that line.
So this spread in the magazine is on one side a report card and on the other a description. Tell me about the report card first.
Right. Well, we decided to put together what you could call bumper stickers on some 36 issues. These range from basic research to immigration to space and health. There are things that they've talked about. There are things that they've issued white papers. They have science advisors in some cases. They've had debates. And we tried to summarize them It's very succinct, and some readers may feel that we've oversimplified, and we apologize. But we thought it would be a helpful scorecard for people to look at before they go to the polls if they haven't made up their mind, or just to confirm what they think where each candidate stands. We've also made the comparison with the current administration because we wanted to give people a baseline. Too often candidates say they will do more or they will do less, and we wanted to make it easy for readers to understand where we are now.
So page 2 of the spread.
Right. So page 2 of the spread picks 10 issues that haven't gotten attention, but that one way or another, the new president and his administration is going to have to tackle. Some of them have to do with regulations. Some of them have to do with abiding by laws that Congress has passed. Some of them have to do with decisions that involve the president's vision. For example, picking a long-term mission to an outer planet is something that NASA is going to have to do fairly early in the new administration. You don't hear them talk about it on the campaign trail, but they are going to have to get up to speed and either with their new NASA administrator or other advisors decide what course they want to take for that next step.
How about the Office of Science itself? I understand that President Bush had moved that office essentially across the street. Is that something that either candidate has weighed in on?
Well, both candidates have separated themselves from President Bush and have promised to restore the integrity of the process by which decisions are made that use science as a basis. But that's easy to say. The harder part is giving that advisor and those administrators an important role to actually make decisions. A lot of scientists feel that the current title of the science advisor doesn't give him an equal seat at the table, and they have urged each candidate to upgrade that position to assistant to the president for science and technology. Senator Obama has recently said that he would do that. Senator McCain has not been explicit. But in either case, the important thing is what happens after they name that person to the position and give him his responsibilities.
Well, that addresses how the president potentially will view the Office of Science. How about the position of U.S. as a science global player with other countries?
That's an important issue, and a lot of people think that the United States isn't keeping up its end of the deal. International projects are more and more common because of the rising cost of any particular scientific facility, and the United States is involved in several of them. The one that's currently being built, an international fusion reactor called ITER, is being paid for by several countries, although it's located in France. Last year, the U.S. decided not to put up its share of its contribution for that year. The next president is going to have to not only decide whether to keep the U.S. in the project, but also convince our partners that we are reliable and can be counted on for years to come.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis on science and the U.S. presidential elections. Find the article, as well as other election 2008 coverage, at www.sciencemag.org/hottopics/election08. Finally today, Eric Stockstead, managing editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Rob. Good to be here. We've got three things to talk about today. First is going to be why women get more cavities than men. Then we're going to talk about a neat transitional fish fossil, some new insights there, and finally wrap up with a surprising discovery about supermassive black holes.
Okay, so why do women get more cavities than men?
It's actually not a new phenomenon. People have known that this was true ever since pretty much people invented agriculture, that women get more cavities than men.
So what's new here then?
What this anthropologist did was look at many published studies of tooth decay in tens of thousands of teeth, both from prehistoric humans and modern humans, all around the world from about 12,000 years ago to 800 years ago. And he found, as people had thought, that women consistently had more cavities in their teeth than men did and do. The idea here that's new is that it might have something to do with fertility, because the transition to agriculture not only made more food available and more sugar-rich food, but it also made women more fertile. And the connection is that pregnancy leads to a couple of changes that impact teeth.
Like what?
Well, in addition to the boost in female sex hormones, pregnancy reduces the amount of saliva, and saliva has antimicrobial properties. And as everybody knows, pregnancy also increases the urge to eat and eat energy-rich food like Snickers bars or other things that might impact your teeth.
So does this suggest a new study, say, of how much being pregnant contributes to cavities in general? Not just with the ancient women's teeth, but with women today?
Well, one thing you could look at is whether the rate of cavities changes when fertility changes, and whether you see a difference there with men and with women. So that might be one way of testing the idea. So one thing they'd like to figure out is how much of this difference in cavities is due to biology, pregnancy, and how much of it is due just to culture, to what people like to eat.
Well, from fossilized teeth to fossilized fish. Tell me about this transitional fish fossil. Is this a missing link kind of fossil?
It is one of those fabulous missing links. And just like Archaeopteryx shed a whole lot of light on the transition from dinosaurs into birds, this fish, called Tiktaalik, tells us a whole lot about how fish evolved into tetrapods, into four-limbed animals. Tiktaalik came to light a couple of years ago, and that told us a whole lot about this transition. It showed, for example, that Tiktaalik is a fish. It has fins and it has scales, but it also had a lot of characteristics of tetrapods, of the animals that conquered the land, such as the presence of a neck, the lack of a bony covering of its gill. So Tiktaalik was right there in the middle, kind of doing both things. What they couldn't tell back then was what was going on inside the skull, and that's because the inside of the skull was still covered by rock, and so preparators had to spend pretty much a whole year just carefully picking away at this rock to remove all the covering and expose what the bones looked like on the inside.
And what'd they find?
A lot of really neat stuff, Rob. For example, they could tell how the bones of the skull connected to each other. Now, in fish, these have a lot of flexibility, and that has to do with how fish eat and how fish breathe, and they distort the shape of their skull to, for example, suck prey in to create a vacuum. So they need a lot of flexibility in their head. Tiktaalik had much less of that flexibility. The head appeared to be more rigid.
Suggesting that it didn't need this flexibility and got its prey some other way?
Well, one idea is that if you are moving out onto land and you don't have water bearing the weight of your body, you might want to have a more rigid skull and so it doesn't deform under the weight of gravity. It also suggests that Tiktaalik was moving more towards air breathing rather than moving water across its gills. And another neat feature of the skull that they discovered was a bone called the hyomandibular bone. Now, in fish, this is a crucial bone that helps orchestrate the motions of the skull, the gill skeleton, coordinates feeding and breathing and respiration. Now, in Tiktaalik, this bone has started to reduce, and it's lost some of those connections, suggesting that it is on its way towards what we do in tetrapods. The hyomandibular bone in you, me, and all other tetrapods has become one of the middle ear bones, the stapes. So Tiktaalik here is, again, a really transitional form there.
So the real exciting part is that we found this fish. We knew these things happened, but we now actually have physical evidence for it.
Absolutely, Rob. We have fish. We know what they're like. We know what tetrapods are like. What really excites paleontologists about this is it shows how this happened. And what it really illustrates is how a series of small steps can take us from one kind of animal to a totally different kind of animal.
Well, from the evolution of the fish to tetrapod to the evolution of our galaxy and universe. In describing this surprising finding about supermassive black holes, remind us what a supermassive black hole is in the first place.
Right. Well, all black holes, as you know, are places where the gravity is so intense that they pretty much pull everything in and not even light can escape, hence they're black. The really big black holes, these supermassive black holes, what's astonishing about them is just the sheer scale of what we're talking about. They have mass equivalent to a million suns that are crammed into a space smaller than our solar system. So they're really big. And they were thought to take a long time to form, to pull all this matter in. And that's what's surprising about this. When this team of astronomers was looking at a faraway galaxy, one that's about 12 billion light years away. So back in the fairly early days of the universe, they were checking out this galaxy that was emitting a lot of radio waves. And the really astonishing thing was that they found not one supermassive black hole there, but actually two. So there were two galaxies in the process of merging, and they each had a supermassive black hole.
Suggesting that there were a lot more than previously thought and that they formed in a relatively short time, right? 12 billion years ago was only 2 billion years or so after the universe formed.
That's right, Rob. So these supermassive black holes appear to be far more common than people had thought for the relatively early days of the universe. And consequently, they must have been forming more rapidly than people thought as well.
So this will sort of put the modelers into a tizzy about how to sort of reform and rethink about how the universe became what it is today.
Right. I see a lot of nod pencil heads out there, or more likely, pretty involved computer simulations.
Okay. Well, thanks, Eric.
My pleasure, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
We've got some news about stem cells regenerating the prostate, erasing memories in mice, and finally, heat-seeking beetles. So be sure to check out the site.
Eric Stockstead is managing editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the October 24th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science and Jeffrey Cook, composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.